tell you about this abstract formulation of quantum and classical mechanics due to Dirac. So you get some flavor of how some of the structures of quantum mechanics are actually mimicked by structures in classical mechanics. So first, recall recall Hamilton's version of classical mechanics. So basically, you have a Hamiltonian function. Which are a function of positions and momenta. And you have the equations of motion. Which is that dq by dt is equal to dh by dp. And dp by dt is equal to minus dh by dq for each coordinate. In general, we consider functions, say f and g, which are functions, can be functions of q, p, and t. And we can define a Poisson bracket for any two such functions, which has the properties property one is anti-symmetry. So fg is equal to minus gf. We can also have linearity. I mean, we also have linearity. So af plus bg against h is equal to A of the Poisson bracket of F and H plus B of the Poisson bracket of G and H. Where A and B are just elements of some scalar field, which we'll just assume to be the complex numbers. Although in classical mechanics, these are normally real. So this is linearity. We have Leibniz's law, sorry, I should add H to this list here, We have the Jacobi identity. Poisson bracket of F with the Poisson bracket of G and H plus the Poisson bracket of H with the Poisson bracket of F and G basically we're looking at all permutations here cyclic permutations I guess is equal to zero. This is the Jacobi identity. And then last but not least, for our kind of primitive elements of the algebra, which are Q and P, we have specific rules, which is that QI Pj is equal to delta ij. Qi Qj is equal to 0. And Pi Pj is equal to 0. Where this is the usual Kronecker delta function. And then we can specify a dynamical law and this is just a postulate instead of specify let me write postulate which is for any of these functions we have the full time derivative of the function is equal to the Poisson bracket of the function with the energy function plus the any explicit time dependence of that function. So then we have a conservation principle. Any function with no explicit time dependence so if the dependence on t which can be in general I mean the function depends on t through q and p varying but it also has an additional time dependence. So if it doesn't have any additional time dependence, then the fact that that function Poisson bracket commutes with h, we'll call this Poisson bracket commutes, implies that that function is a conserved quantity. So clearly, the energy function will commute with itself, and so therefore it's conserved, as long as it doesn't have any explicit time dependence. Now, Dirac observed that if we assume,
so you said that if f doesn't have an explicit time dependence,
right,
then the Poisson bracket with h q is zero.
Whoops, thank you. This is an and. Thanks. If we assume the algebra elements qi and pi are commutative, which means that qp is equal to PQ, and of course that QI QJ is equal to QJ QI, and so on. So all elements commute. Then there exists a representation of the Poisson bracket as a differential operator. Well, here I'm making all kinds of assumptions about smooth manifolds and things like that. So we have, in particular, bracket of two functions f and g of the p's and q's is equal to sum over alpha. I'm just assuming three-dimensional space here. So we're summing over the x, y, and z coordinates, and then we're summing over the particles, and we get df by dq I alpha. I guess my notation is changing a bit, so let me be notationally consistent with the way I started the lecture. And you know what? Let me just improve the notation. So there, that what I wrote up there would be just in one dimension, and so I'm generalizing to three dimensions. Wow, that's pretty obvious, so I won't write it down. Okay. We can take partials of f and g with respect to these distinguished variables. Assuming f and g are differentiable. So we can just say, consider polynomials f and g as an important class of functions. So then we have df by dt is equal to the Poisson bracket of f and g, which is this expression. And what I want you to realize is that now df by dt, so let is equal to f comma h plus del f by del t. So now if we substitute h in for g, we're going to get dh by dp and dh by dq. Which, what are those? That's Hamilton's equations of motion. So just here in 1D for one particle, what you get is df by dq, dh by dp, minus df by dp, dh by dq, plus df by dt. And dh by dp is equal to dq by dt minus df by dp, and dh by dq is equal to minus dp by dt. Which is just the chain rule for F. Chain rule, right? Yeah. So now one can, and I mentioned this yesterday in the tutorial, now if we let F equal to rho, which is a probability density on the phase space, which is spanned by Q and P, then basically the flow of this probability density corresponds to an incompressible fluid, and you can show that the full derivative of rho with respect to time must be zero. Whence the partial of rho with respect to t is equal to the Poisson bracket of h and rho. I don't need to do that. Sorry. So this is, sorry, just, yeah?
Do we mean by positive probability density something positive that integrates to 1 over the?
Yeah, exactly. A probability density on the phase space. So basically, this means that rho is a function of q, p, and t. Rho is non-negative, and the integral over all the dq's and dp's of rho is equal to 1 over the whole phase space. So this the argument which implies this is given, for example, in good textbooks on classical mechanics such as Goldstein. And I won't go through the details of it, but suffice to say the classical mechanics is correct, and this is the way to describe the evolution of a phase space density. Sure, that's a great idea. Which aspect of it?
Those interpretation and why it's important and why we would like to derive it, how we use it.
The Liouville equation?
Yeah.
Basically the motivation for the Liouville equation, now I touched on this in the discussion with some of you in the tutorial yesterday, but the motivation for the Liouville equation is it gives a description, of the realistic scenario, which is that I don't know the positions and momenta precisely, but only have some finite resolution. So I don't know exactly at time. So let's consider the time t equals 0, and I want to know the position and the momentum so I can describe, say, the ballistic motion of some object. Well, if I knew exactly the position and momentum, I'd use Newton's laws or Hamilton's equations of motion, and I'd predict where it will be. But if I don't know exactly its initial configuration, but just do some, finite precision measurement, then I have some. I can describe that with error bars. Or another way to describe it is just to assign a probability density to the possible values with relative weights. So I might say, okay, well, I measured this to be q equals q naught and p equals p naught, but really I'm going to put a Gaussian probability distribution centered on q and p naught with a width associated with my measurement resolution and say, okay, well, that's a better representation of what I actually know about the system. And then given that I have that finite uncertainty, I want to say, well, now what do I know about where the system will be at some later time t? And then I can just time evolve my knowledge parameterized as a probability density, time evolve that, and then I know where the particle will end up with what probability based on my assessment of my initial knowledge. So one has uncertainty at any given time due to finite precision of measurements. Finite precision or coarseness of measurements. And so, but I mean, in practice doing classical mechanics, one, I think it's not very common to use this technique. It's more common to just use error bars. But formally, one could go about, I mean, certainly there are scenarios that might arise where one actually says, I have some source that prepares the particles and it prepares them with some probability distribution to be in different positions and momenta, and I want to describe the time evolution of the particles coming out of that source. Maybe something like that, which is very analogous to quantum mechanics, of course. And but the main point here is going to be the fact that we get a very profound conceptual similarity between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics when we cast classical mechanics in this way. And that will give us some conceptual insight into quantum mechanics, which will help us reason about quantum mechanical problems. So now Dirac's genius, kind of, so Dirac realized that one could deduce the quantum mechanical formalism from this abstract formulation of classical mechanics by making essentially one change. So those of you who were at the tutorial yesterday, do you know what that one change is? Right. If we assume that these quantities Q and P, which describe our system, if we assume that these are non-commutative operators, if we assume, sorry, they're non-commutative algebra elements, so dropping the assumption that the algebra elements Q and P commute, then that means that this is no longer a representation of the Poisson bracket. This right-hand side is no longer a representation of this abstract product, because we don't have, for one thing, we don't have a well-defined notion of what's happening here in these derivatives. And what's even more surprising, okay, so then the differential form is no longer a representation. So that differential form actually gives us classical mechanics via this connection between the chain rule and the Poisson bracket. Is no longer valid. And not only is it not valid, but there is a unique representation of the Poisson bracket for such a case. And there is a unique representation of the Poisson bracket as the Poisson bracket of two functions f and g is equal to some constant c times the product fg minus gf. For some scalar c, which is a complex, could be a complex number. So go ahead.
So the differential form is the differential representation of a Poisson bracket as a differential operator is no longer valid. But what about the commutator of, say, two components being the momentum, which is another component being the momentum? Can't represent that as a differential operator.
In the classical picture? Well, you can't, because we just said you can't. So what is it that?
So I'm not certain about this. I was just generalizing. So we represent, let's say, x and p in quantum mechanics by differential operators. So I was thinking maybe we could represent other quantum mechanical operators by differential operators. Examples of such quantum mechanical operators are the components of angular momentum, and the commutator of two angular momentum components with each other is another angular momentum component. If thought maybe that angular momentum component is like x and v, and that we can represent it by a differential operator, in which case we have a commutator to quantum-mechanical operators that equals a differential operator. But if, can we not represent, let's say, Lz by a differential operator the way that we represent x and v?
Sure. So yes, there exists a representation of Lz as a differential operator, and that's where your base, it's a differential operator on a Hilbert space, and that Hilbert space is the Hilbert space of spherical harmonics, say, which would be a basis for the, so, but representing F as a differential operator is a different issue than representing the Poisson bracket itself as a differential operator acting on F. You see what I mean? So you're, there's two kind of independent things happening in what you're discussing. One is what we're talking about, given F and G, which are just algebra elements, how do we represent the action of the Poisson bracket product of those two? How do we evaluate what the right-hand side of this is? And then, so this differential form is one way of evaluating what the right-hand side is. Now you can also deduce, if I give you, so here's an exercise. I give you F and G as simple polynomials of Q and P. Then you can use the five axioms I gave you, the five properties, defining properties of the Poisson bracket, to evaluate that commutator without using a representation. So one can evaluate the commutator without a representation. So I just want to make sure that's clear. But then you can also go to the representation and evaluate the Poisson bracket, sorry, via these derivatives. And the question of how one represents F and G is really, really a separate issue altogether. So if F and G are angular momentum functions, or if they're position polynomials and position and momentum, whatever they are, you see that there's a difference there.
So when we were talking about just classical mechanics and said that we can represent a Poisson bracket by a differential operator, do we really mean that we can evaluate a Poisson bracket by acting on its contents with differential operators?
Mm-hmm. In the classical setting.
Okay.
So now you have two ways. So the point is, when I give you this representation, now you have two different techniques by which to evaluate the Poisson bracket of F and G. One is manipulate it using properties 1 through 5, and the other is, well, just substitute in here and evaluate these derivatives. So these, and they'll both give you the same answer. But now if Q and P are non-commutative, and so F and G are functions of these non-commutative algebra elements, then you won't get the same answer anymore. In fact, I probably have to think for a moment. I guess, yeah, one could still define these derivatives, but the point is you wouldn't get the right answer because, you know, this object doesn't handle non-commutativity in the right way. But if they're non-commutative, then there is a different representation you could use as an alternative to just directly using the defining properties to evaluate the bracket. One can instead just do this simple thing, just multiply F times G and subtract out the product of G times F, where you respect the non-commutativity, of course, of the algebra. And then, of course, we can define this to be C times a new object, which we use square brackets for. So this defines the commutator. So we define the commutator just to be this representation of the Poisson bracket. And then, of course, we determine for consistency conditions and empirical constraints, we need C to be equal to 1 over IH bar, which is, we put that in by hand. Oh. By the way, it's really good that they, you know, have the blackboards clean before each lecture, because it's so much nicer writing on a clean blackboard.
Is there a question?
Oh, I missed it. Yeah.
So I missed what you were trying to say about the 0 dt equals to 0. So are you saying that the value of rho is the same at every single point in phase space at any time, as it is constant?
Yeah, so have you ever, okay, so what's going on here is actually really subtle. So I'm not going through the details for two reasons. One is that just it's not the focus of, it's not maybe worth the time spent, but the other is that it's tricky to keep track of and explain. So basically, the gist of the idea is that you have some probability density, which I'll represent with contour lines. So you imagine this is like looking at a contour map where this would be a mountain. And so this is, say, the high point, and then it drops off. So this is our probability density at some time t naught. And the problem is analogous to think about in fluid dynamics, if you have some region of your fluid, and it's an incompressible fluid, then the kind of the volume of that region can't change.
So do you mean that the intrinsic derivative is zero? Not the total derivative.
The total derivative is zero. So basically what happens is the argument goes something like this. You follow the flow line of any individual point has some flow line associated with Hamilton's equations of motion. And then you realize that points on the surface of this region, but for simplicity, let's just imagine this is a step function. So this function rho is 1 inside here and 0 outside. Then you realize that because lines can't cross in phase space because of deterministic trajectories, all of the points on the edge go to points on the edge, and all of the points in the interior go to points in the interior. So points don't cross the line. So kind of if you think of this as the number of trajectories per unit area on the phase space, that's conserved. And so that's the key property that allows you to deduce this, that's kind of like an incompressible fluid property. And so what happens is this, so what one has is the area is conserved, but the shape is not conserved. Sorry, what do you mean more precisely?
Develop holes.
No. So, yeah, so this topology, yes, that's right. So, this topology would be conserved. Because lines can't cross is the, I think, maybe all you need for that. But
for chaotic systems, this thing just spreads out.
Yeah, so basically, so what's interesting is what happens with a chaotic system is a very interesting question. And what happens with a chaotic system is how does this property, how is that consistent with this chaotic explosion of, because you, I mean, remember, this represents our uncertainty, and our uncertainty is supposed to grow. So imagine if this is some time interval delta t, regular motion would produce something like this. What chaotic motion would produce is that this would evolve to something like this. So you get this really complicated shape so that the total volume is conserved, but you get this filamentary structure of the possible sets of locations. And so whenever you have a finite resolution measurement, you know, basically you're coarse graining over this, so it looks like the particle is equally likely to be found anywhere. So what happens is kind of the detailed structure of this shape gets exponentially more complex. And so that's how you get... that's how you have. So as I mentioned in the tutorial, this Liouville equation is a linear differential equation linear in rho. It corresponds to a continuous time evolution. And last but not least, it is deterministic in the sense of rho is determined. And so as you probably all have guessed, and some of you have heard yesterday, this is exactly analogous to the von Neumann equation. of quantum mechanics. So now these formal properties of the von Neumann equation are mimicked by this classical equation for incomplete knowledge. And right, so then basically you get the von Neumann equation. So now we let F be a state operator. Oh, so a step I'm skipping now is the following thing. For those of you who are very mathematically inclined, if you have some algebra F and G, which satisfy a commutator, then there are powerful theorems due to Stone and von Neumann, which identify now the representations of non-commutative algebras that have a commutator relationship. And so one can prove rigorously that if I have this algebra, and if it's non-commutative, and one has, now I've defined the commutator of F and G, but now we use, let me erase this. Now, given that FG is equal to FG over IH bar, and given that when F and G are equal to P and Q, we have then, this implies that QI alpha PJ beta is then equal to delta alpha beta delta IJ. I think my IH bar is in the wrong place here. Let me check my notes. Oh, yeah, that's right. Right. So that means that the commutator of FG is equal to IH bar times the Poisson bracket. The Poisson bracket of Q and P is equal to just the delta function as given by property 5. Then we have the theorem, we have theorems of von Neumann and Stone. Tell us that Q and P have to be operators, linear operators acting on a Hilbert space. Which I thought I had written down in my notes. Okay, for some reason I don't have this written down, but basically based on memory, theorems in von Neumann and Stone imply that the Q's and the P's admit an irreducible representation as linear operators on a Hilbert space H, which is actually the Hilbert space of square integrable functions, which I will discuss in some detail in a subsequent lecture. So just accept for now that this is, I'll define this later. Nicole?
Why is it by hand C equals 1 over IH bar? Do you think it works?
Yeah. I don't know of a deeper reason. There may be one, but I'm content with constants being set by experiment. That doesn't bother me too much. But it would be nice if one didn't have that freedom, I agree. I think that this idea of kind of understanding principles which distinguish quantum and classical mechanics is an unfinished research program. This is an interesting part of that story. There's very other different approaches which are studied here at PI and elsewhere that try and look at principles that imply quantum versus classical mechanics using a very different framework than this. And so there's still work to be done, which is what which is going to be up to you guys. Yeah.
So the value of the value of H bar is completely independent. So by experiment, but it depends on what you need to choose.
Yeah, sure. That sounds like a good answer. Then we just have to explain the I.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, this is something I've thought about and don't have a good answer to. I mean, by the way, this argument I'm giving you, well, about 80% of this argument is directly from Dirac's 1950s textbook, Principles of Quantum Mechanics, and the rest is filled in from other sources and my own thinking. So this is great. So we get the fact that the Poisson bracket is a commutator. We get the fact that if we have operators, if we have algebra elements Q and P, which satisfy this commutator relationship, then we can use some powerful mathematics to imply that these admit a, it turns out that it's not a unique representation, which is one of the kind of unhappy pieces of this argument. If you massage it a little bit, you can get a unique representation as the quantum one. But it involves using, it involves looking at the commutative relationship between e to the iq and e to the ip, which is actually more, okay, this is a total aside. It's actually much more natural to think about this because when you think about q and p as observables, it's a bit harder to argue operationally what that means that they're not commutative. But if you think of them as generators of translations, then you can make some very strong group theoretic arguments about what it means for them to be non-commutative. So that's all just for those of you who are interested in thinking about that. But anyway, so it's not unique, but still it's pretty impressive that we get at least some representation, which is exactly quantum mechanics. So what you get, so basically this, by the way, then, well, okay, so now we have this piece. Then the last piece, before I get to the last piece, let me just say that this derivation, if we assume Q and P don't commute, then this result follows. This is essentially a half-page derivation from using only properties 1 through 5. And I have it written in my notes. I'm not going to go through it because it's not that interesting to go through just some kind of, you know, some bookkeeping type calculation. But this might be an interesting problem, an exercise to go through in the tutorial or something, just to see that you're forced to interpret the Poisson bracket as the commutator. It's kind of amazing for me that's what happens. So now we have that these objects are linear operators on a Hilbert space. And now the last piece we need to get you know, normal wave mechanics is to use the fundamental dynamical law. So as before, So we use the Poisson bracket, and now we're using the dynamical law on the far right-hand top there. And then it follows that for some f, which we'll just call rho, now we use a hat. The hat is just a reminder that we're dealing with a non-commutative algebra now. That's all the hat means. And then we get that d rho by dt is equal to let's not do that. I'm going to use the Heisenberg picture. So we get that df by dt is equal to the commutator of f with h plus the explicit time dependence of f. And I should have an IH bar somewhere. Does f come first over here? Yeah. OK, so you recognize this as Heisenberg's equation of motion. And once we have the Heisenberg picture, then we can switch to the Schrodinger picture. And the Schrodinger picture, we get d rho by dt is equal to, what is the, I don't have it yet. Does anyone remember for the von Neumann equation, does h come first? Could you check your notes, please? So OK, now I'm going to admit here that there's some question in my mind about how you use this argument. I mean, clearly, there's going to be d rho by dt, where rho is the state operator, is going to be 0, or clearly in the sense that that has to be true for this argument to work, not clearly in the sense of here's why that follows. So there's some piece of this argument which I have to think about to remember how it works, and it may not even work rigorously. I have to think about it. And so this is the von Neumann equation. And there's some funny business here because of the fact that in the classical picture, we have a partial with respect to rho, because rho is a different kind of object. So classically, rho is just some function of q, p, and t, where q and p are time evolving, and so it can depend on time both through the change of q and p, as well as through its own independent time dependence. But in the quantum picture, rho just becomes some operator which isn't the function of other coordinates. And so the notion of distinguishing between the full derivative and the partial derivative doesn't make sense anymore in this context. And so whether there's some kind of careful argument you can go through so that that all hangs together nicely or not, I'm not entirely sure. I'd have to spend some time thinking about it. I've tried to figure it out and haven't really succeeded. But so I'm just going to do a wave of the hand, and you can accept this. Maybe one of you can think this through and figure it out, and that would be great. I mean, I think the fact that we get the Heisenberg equation of motion is enough then to say the rest of the structure follows, but I'm not certain of that. Yeah, I guess that probably is enough. But anyways, I always get kind of troubled by the fact that one has this kind of unusual feature, which is that in the classical picture, there's two kinds of time derivatives, the full and the partial. But in the quantum picture, one only has one kind of time derivative because of the nature of the object. And so I'm just you know, I'm lifting up the rug and sweeping the dirt out to show you guys, okay? So this is something that troubles me a bit, and I'll just leave it at that.
So yeah. If we start with the Schrodinger equation and put the Hamiltonian to be a time-dependent Hamiltonian, then this should follow, right?
Well, let's assume the Hamiltonian is time independent.
Even if it, then it follows like trivial, right? From the definition of a density.
Yeah, clearly we know that the Schrodinger and the Heisenberg pictures are equivalent because we've seen it. But what isn't clear to me is whether or not you use other properties of the quantum axioms plus the Heisenberg picture to derive the Schrodinger picture. And I don't know if this argument gave us those properties that we may need to interconvert between the two. So that's kind of the piece that may or may not be missing. It just would take, I think, a few hours or days of kind of working through it carefully and sorting out these details. I think there would be a nice kind of pedagogical value to understanding it, but it's not enormously important to me, which is why I haven't spent that time doing it. I think the important message from this framework is that we have a common theoretical framework in which quantum mechanics and classical mechanics come out as special cases, and you know exactly what additional assumptions you need to make maybe aren't crystal clear, but that you have that commonality of structure is important both, I think, for understanding deeply the theoretical structure of mechanics, both in the quantum and classical setting, and also for this kind of quantum foundations-y perspective, which is that the appropriate analog of a quantum state operator, even if it's a pure state, is a classical density with finite support, some kind of classical uncertainty, a state of classical uncertainty about the properties of the system. And that has all of the formal, so just like we saw with the von Neumann equation, that this is a linear, continuous, deterministic equation, so is the Liouville equation. And the last but not least piece of this argument is what I mentioned yesterday during the tutorial, which is that the classical state update rule after a measurement, where now not only do we model our states as uncertain knowledge, but we also model our measurements as having finite resolution. So a measurement consists of, so a measurement classically in this picture consists of a set of objects CL, where L goes from 1 to some capital L, such that CL is equal to 0 or 1. And in particular, you have some region delta L, which is a subset of the phase space, basically a phase space cell, so one has a region delta L, and the idea is that CL of QP is equal to 1 if Q and P are in this region, and otherwise it's equal to 0 if Q and P are not in that region. So we're creating kind of we're breaking up the phase space into cells. And each cell is like a region we can detect, that we can distinguish from other regions. So you have the phase space P and Q, And then each of these regions would be individual cells, delta L. So this would be, say, a cell indexed by L. So L goes from 1, 2, all the way to capital L. And then the probability of getting outcome L is the integral over the phase space of dq dp of CL of Q and P against the Liouville density of Q, P at time T. And then if we get outcome L, how do we update the state? The update rule is equal to rho goes to rho prime, which is equal to the intersection of CL. So here we have outcome L naught. So it's the intersection of L naught with rho, and then renormalized by, so that the normalization is 1. So we want the integral over dq dp of this object to be equal to 1. So we just divide by whatever it's equal to. So now it's important to realize that the classical update rule is inconsistent with the linear with the Liouville equation. Liouville. In the sense that it's not linear, it's not continuous, and it's not deterministic. So the point is that one doesn't look at the framework of classical mechanics and get troubled about the fact that this update rule doesn't follow from Hamilton's equations of motion. It's an obvious application of just Bayesian update, and the fact is that it's just, well, you're gaining information about the system, so of course you need some rule to implement that process of acquiring information. And so, you know, something that really only occurred to me yesterday when someone was asking me a question about this, one of you, I can't remember which of you, pointed out, well, okay, so you've explained the update rule process, the selective update, the conditioning update of quantum mechanics is essentially the same as classical mechanics. But what about the other case? Remember the non-conditioned update where you summed over the projectors. And I showed you that follows from the axioms of quantum mechanics. So all the consternation of Dirac and von Neumann was about what they called process 1, which is this update rule, and not about process 2. But what's interesting is the place where quantum mechanics and classical mechanics differ is actually the other rule, the rule that does follow from unitary evolution. So if I do this measurement on my classical system and I don't see the outcome, then how do I describe the updated state? I would just sum over these guys. Now, if I sum over these guys for all L, what do I get as my state after measurement? You guys should know this.
Rho itself.
You get rho back again, right? So the non-conditioned update state after measurement is that rho goes to rho, which is equal to a sum over L CL intersection rho. Because the sum over L CL adds to 1, which I hope I mentioned here. Oh, yeah, so you have to have this property. Oh, it's equal to the phase space, sorry. The idea is that the CLs span the phase space. So it's the intersection of the whole phase space with rho, which is just rho. So, but quantum mechanics, so classically, if you don't look at the result, you get the same state again. Quantum mechanically, if you don't look at the result, you don't get the same state. What you do is get a state where the coherences have been destroyed with respect to the basis in which you measured. So we see the difference between quantum and classical mechanics isn't in the rule that people have argued about for 70 years. It's in the rule that people haven't been arguing about, which is the fact that quantum measurements, as we know, are disturbing, and so they destroy the coherence of the quantum state.
So do you need delta in the sum?
Yeah, I do, actually. So there's some. All right, my mathematical notation might be. Thank you for catching this. So there's. How do I write this out? I guess I'd want to integrate over. What do I want to say here? To say that.
You can just do rho times psi out, because then that'll pick out the vectors inside delta.
Rho times? Oh, here, for instead of intersection? Right. I can just use multiplication. But we should have, I would think you can write an explicit sum over L. Oh, right. Oh, that's what it is. Right. So actually, this is the intersection of delta L with rho. That's actually what I want to do. That's the intersection there. And then we sum over these guys, and we just get rho again. Thanks. So anyway, so that's, I think, an interesting story. Deborah?
Where does pseudo probability distribution come in?
The quasi probability stuff?
Is there a representation of this in terms of position and conflict?
So it doesn't come in directly, but that's an interesting. I haven't thought about it. I haven't thought about how you would use this story to look at the quasi probability picture. So the quasi probability picture, which I discussed in the tutorial and the rest of you haven't heard about, is. Basically, it's a way of representing quantum mechanics in phase space, and then it's a rule for identifying appropriate CLs associated with appropriate projectors and appropriate phase space densities rho that are to be associated with preparations. And so a quasi-probability representation is about finding such pairs of maps, and quantum mechanics is not classical, so it's not actually possible to use convexity-preserving maps or affine maps to do that. And so, I don't even know if I can go there right now, because that's a long, there's a lot of background information I have to present. Yeah.
You say the difference in the non-conditioned state after measurement between classical and quantum is due to the fact that we're disturbing the system in quantum and not in classical.
Yeah.
If you were to take two classical probability regions and say collide them and conserve momentum, what would you get? Would it be the same as the quantum case?
Hold on a second. Let me just write down. This is the same as QM. When I say the same, I mean conceptually the same. So what was the last piece of your question?
Let's say you were to take two probability regions.
Here's the difference. The difference is this. It comes back to the fact that the difference is the following. And here A is any non-negative number. So in classical electromagnetic theory, what's the kind of the best way to measure things? Well, the best particle to use is, well, the best means is light. So light is the kind of the most convenient way to do things. It's optimal in many ways, which I hope you take for granted. So the point is, with classical light of a given frequency, I can turn the intensity down, which is in some sense loosely connected with the amount of energy in the beam. I can tune it down as close to zero as I want. So I can, if I want to measure this object by doing that von Neumann analysis where I take into account another system, which I scatter off of the first system, and then collect information to infer properties of the system of interest, which is what you're getting at. The point is, I can make that disturbance arbitrarily small. So you tell me your epsilon and delta precision for this analysis. I'll find some tunable value of A for which my disturbance will never be detected by your resolution. But in the quantum setting, thanks to Einstein, we know that light from the photoelectric effect comes in integer multiples of some energy unit associated with the frequency. Now, if I want to increase my spatial resolution, I have to increase the frequency. So once I get the spatial resolution that I want, that fixes a minimum frequency, which fixes a minimum energy with n equals 1 that I'm going to be imparting as a momentum kick to the system. So in quantum mechanics, there is a minimum disturbance, which we can't avoid. But in classical electromagnetism, there's no minimum disturbance. So that means that I don't have to bother going through that analysis of what happens when I measure, because I know I can make the measurements negligible. So classically, I do in principle have to interact with the system, but in practice, it can be made arbitrarily small, the disturbance. But in the quantum mechanical setting, it can't be made arbitrarily small. So that's the key conceptual distinction. I hope, is that getting at what you were getting at? Yes.
Okay. Just need to clarify that word there, which is a conceptual understanding there. And UREP of.
Yes.
What is UREP?
This is an irreducible representation.
Okay.
If you're not familiar with representation theory, just think of it as a representation. The fact that it's irreducible gives it certain nice properties that mean that we don't have redundancies in our representation, basically.
But I'm not sure if I misunderstood you, but you mentioned that more precisely, it's to consider the exponential IQ and exponential IP.
Yeah.
So that means this formulation of non-commutative Hamiltonian mechanics, or what we call quantum mechanics, is not complete in a sense. Is that what you're saying? Or?
No, what I was saying is that, so ignore that. What this says is that there are theorems due to von Neumann and Stone which show that once we have algebras satisfying the above properties, there exists an irreducible representation of Q and P as linear operators on a Hilbert space. So remember, what's quantum mechanics? It's linear algebra, which is linear operators acting on Hilbert space. So what we're doing is we're taking the Poisson algebra, we're taking the non-commutativity assumption, that's all we're assuming, and we get that these algebra elements Q and P can be realized as matrices acting on a vector space. This is a direct, the point is we don't put that in by hand anymore. It's just that structure of quantum mechanics comes out of this very abstract reasoning, which is, I hope your minds are all blown that this has been accomplished by the founders, basically to show that structure of quantum mechanics, which one normally just starts with, follows from some very simple considerations and some pretty powerful mathematics. The only problem is when I say admits an EREP, that means, well, there could be other representations of these operators in different mathematical forms. in different different Hilbert spaces, or I'm not even clear on what the alternatives would be. But the point is, if you change the argument a little bit, you can show that this representation is the unique representation for these algebra elements. Because, I mean, you want to know that it's unique. I mean, you kind of want to say, well, if these are the principles that imply quantum mechanics, I don't want to be using a representation which is just a special case. I want to be using a representation which is in one-to-one correspondence with this algebra. And so what I'm saying is that there's some modifications. If you're interested in it as a side issue, there are some modifications of this argument which make the argument more complicated, but which allow you to deduce that this is the unique irreducible representation. And that argument involves looking at the generators of translations. Instead of just thinking of these as observables, we think of these in some kind of group theoretic sense. And so I haven't given you really any meat on the bones there, but just pointed you to the fact that if you're interested in this topic, there's some work done on it already. In the back?
So quantum mechanics and quantum mechanics have the same structure.
Yes.
Do we know, is it just an observation, or do we have to prove why it's the case, why they have this similar structure?
Let me just say, well, it's at least an observation. You know, I don't know what you do with it at this point. I mean, really, this gives some sense of what the relationship between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics are. I mean, okay, well, I already said this, but for me, I think the value of it is in that it ties into, I mean, so personally, I think that there's new physics to be discovered. I don't think with, you know, in 1932, when quantum mechanics was written down axiomatically by Dirac, that, you know, new physics ended, that somehow we're in this, that's it. I think that there's more physics to be discovered. And so I think understanding the abstract principles which give us classical mechanics versus quantum mechanics is one possible path towards discovering other theories which would coincide in slightly different ways, which would differ from quantum mechanics and classical mechanics in some other way. So this is really just, I mean, most of you, I hope, are looking at long careers in theoretical experimental physics, and I think this is kind of a very profound connection between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics that will give value to you in your understanding of those theories. So that's why I'm presenting it. But what exactly it implies beyond that, it's more open-ended. Yeah, was there someone else who raised their hand quickly, or Tibra?
So, in certain quantum field theory courses, what we do is that we start with a classical system, and then we quantize the system. Mm-hmm. Basically, what we do, we replace the Poisson bracket by a commutator divided by IHR. Mm-hmm. So this is the basis.
This is the motivation for doing that. This is the rationale for that substitution. Exactly. Of course, all you need in practice is just making that assumption, but what this is showing is that assumption follows from other deeper principles.
I also remember, what kind of operators e to the I q?
E to the I q?
It's not a translation operator, which is e to the I p.
No, it is a translation. So e to the I p generates translations in position. E to the IQ generates translations in momentum. Because we usually work in the position picture, and so we're used to E to the IP. And so similar. So basically, E to the IH generates translations in time. I'm saying this for the rest of the class. I know you know this. E to the IP generates translations in position. E to the IQ generates translations in momentum. E to the I J alpha generates translations of what type?
Rotations.
I don't know if you call them translations, but rotations, right. So, this is a convenient thing to know. And so if you commute with H, you're conserved in time. If you commute with P, then you're conserved, your motion is fixed. And if you commute with angular momentum, that means you, you're invariant under rotations, is the right way to say it, I think.
All right. Well, basically, that's what I was trying to see. If I commute with Q, what am I? Is there like a conservation?
Yeah, it's a bit weird because, I mean, Hamiltonian mechanics has an asymmetry between P and Q, which is the Hamiltonian always has the kinetic energy term. So you can drop the potential. So it's reasonable to have a Hamiltonian which doesn't depend on Q, but it's not meaningful to have a Hamiltonian that doesn't depend on P. And so that's why the... So mathematically it's true, but physically it's irrelevant, I guess, is the point. I think that's right. Okay, well, I should probably wrap up. So... All right, well, anyway, so that's that story, and I guess tomorrow morning we'll talk about Bell's theorem and all the beautiful properties that come out of that.